It's an amazing prophecy that we just read, kind of a cryptic prophecy, one that has inspired lots of different interpretations, Ezekiel chapter 28. And in thinking about where to begin in discussing God's great enemy, Satan, there are lots of different options that are available. As we know, Satan is always, or usually today, depicted as some hideously evil, ugly enemy of God. You know, sometimes comically with a red suit and a pitchfork. Other times with just the most hideous type of image that you could possibly imagine. And I think that Satan actually loves it when we think this way. Back in 1968, the Rolling Stones released a song called Sympathy for the Devil. I'm sure that I'd be surprised if there were 10 people in the congregation that had not heard this and didn't know the song. It's so ubiquitous. But he begins to, in the song, Satan is speaking, and Satan is introducing himself. And the chorus says, "Please." The chorus says, I'm pleased to meet you. I hope you guessed my name, right? And so the words to the song, Mick Jagger begins singing, please allow me to introduce myself. I'm a man of wealth and taste. I've been around for a long, long year, stole many a man's soul and faith. I was around when Jesus Christ had his moment of doubt and pain, and I made sure that Pilate washed his hands and sealed his fate. I'm pleased to meet you. I hope you guessed my name, but what's puzzling you is the nature of my game. I stuck around St. Petersburg when I thought it was time for a change. I killed the Tsar and his ministers. Anastasia screamed out in vain. I rode a tank, held a general's rank when the blitzkrieg raged and the bodies stank. I watched with glee while your kings and queens fought for 10 decades for the gods they made. I shouted out, who killed the Kennedys? When after all, it was you and me. Let me please introduce myself. I'm a man of wealth and taste. I laid traps for troubadours who got killed before they reached Bombay. Just as every cop is a criminal and all the sinner saints, as heads as tails, they call me Lucifer. Because I'm in need of some restraint. So if you meet me, have some courtesy. Have some sympathy. Have some taste. Use your well-learned polities, or I'll lay your soul to waste. I'm pleased to meet you. I hope you guessed my name. But what's puzzling you is the nature of my game. Now, unsurprisingly, in the devil's world, this is a song that has received almost universal critical acclaim. It features on Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs of All Times list, and it came in at number 32, just under Stairway to Heaven, which is another gem. My favorite song, Won't You Drop Kick Me Jesus Through the Goalpost of Life, didn't make the list at all.
Drop kick me Jesus through the goalposts of life. End over end, neither left nor to right. Straight through the heart of them righteous uprights. Drop kick me Jesus through the goalposts of life.
They have no taste today, folks. This song is on no lists anywhere. Well, anyway. It turns out, though, that Mick Jagger and Keith Richards wrote the music to this. Mick Jagger wrote the lyrics. Got quite a bit right in their description of God's great enemy, because he is indeed the spirit behind every act of evil, every war, every assassination, all throughout human history. To be more accurate, though, we could consider a list of indictments that the Bible gives against Satan. That God makes himself, either directly or through his prophets. This list was compiled by Dr. Lewis Berry Schaefer, who is the co-founder and first chancellor of Dallas Theological Seminary. Here are just a few of them. First of all, Satan repudiated God from the very beginning. That is, as we shall see, long before the creation of the first woman and first man. He drew one-third. Imagine how clever he is to have drawn one-third of the angels away from the worship of God in heaven and to himself. One-third. Jesus himself called him a murderer from the very beginning and the father of the lie. In the Garden of Eden, he belittled God. He counseled Eve to rebel against her good creator who loved her and walked with her and Adam in the cool of each day. He insinuated to Yahweh that Job, his faithful servant, only served him because he benefited from the deal. I can't think of a greater insult that you could level against God than that he's not worthy to be followed and worshiped and praised just because of his own glorious person. Then we see, and we'll see this in detail later, not today, but later, then we see that given permission by God, Satan brought five terrible calamities upon that godly man. Then Satan stood up against Israel. You remember the prophecy was that your children, Israel, will be numberless. They'll be like the sands of the sea. And in 1 Chronicles chapter 21, 1, Satan stood up against Israel. Satan stood up and incited David to number the people. And then we find other places as well where there are indictments that Isaiah gives against what he has done in the world, in the nations, in our cities. Isaiah 14 mentions that he weakens the nations, that he makes the earth tremble, that he shakes the kingdoms of the earth, that he makes the world a wilderness, and that he destroys the cities thereof. And is he destroying the cities in America today? Revelation chapter 20, verses 2 and then 7 and 8 tell us that he causes wars and all of the horrors that follow war. We see that when the devil is locked up, all war on earth will cease for that 1,000 years. And then when he's released for a little bit, Revelation chapter 20, verses 7 and 8 says, he immediately seeks to gather people together for battle against the Lord. Luke and Matthew tell us that he tempted the Holy Son of God for 40 days and 40 nights, and then he departed from him for a more opportune season. So after Jesus defeated the devil in this contest in the wilderness, refused to give in to the temptations of the devil, the Bible doesn't say that Satan gave up. It just says he waited for a more opportune time to test him again. And there are a number of these. Again, all we're doing is priming the pump today. We're going to go deep with these things in the weeks to come. Dr. Luke also tells us that he bound a daughter of Israel with a painful physical malady for 18 years. What do we draw from that? It was the devil that did that. It was the devil that made that woman sick. So what can we say from that? That all illness is from the devil? No. I don't believe all illness is directly caused by the devil, but it certainly is something that the devil can do. Jesus cured this woman after 18 years of illness by casting out a demon. Supernatural realities everywhere. Jesus didn't walk around in some scientific fog where his worldview was somehow impacted by the things that we know or think we know. Jesus understood things as they are, and he told us things as they are, and he is the way and the truth, the only way and the only truth and the only life. John tells us that Satan entered into Judas. It's a horrifying passage. At the Last Supper, Satan entered into Judas, seducing him to betray the very Lord of life. He always has and still today blinds the minds of those who are lost in our city, in the city of Woonsocket. There are those who are lost, and Satan is actively working to blind their minds so that they will not see the truth of the gospel of Jesus Christ. That's the declaration of Paul in 1 Corinthians. Jesus himself said that Satan actively works to steal away the seeds that are planted in the unsaved in his parable of the sower. The seed is broadcast. The seed is always good, falls on four different kinds of ground. But remember the birds that come and they snatch that seed. And Jesus said, this is the enemy that does this. He holds men and women captive by the slavery. He holds men and women captive in slavery by the fear of death. I mentioned it last week, and I'll mention it again today. If there's one thing that should characterize a mature, born-again Christian, it should be the absence of the fear of death. That is the work of the devil. We've been freed from that. We're going to leave this life, and I understand it. There are people that we love, and there are people that we leave behind. But we'll see them again if those folks know the Lord Jesus. But we move from this life into another glorious life. Fear should not have anything to do with the believer's understanding of that great passage from this life into the next. Peter describes Satan as a dangerous adversary. Now, this is important because it's coming from Peter, and we're going to see why it's significant that it's coming from Peter. I'll mention to you, by the way, this isn't a seminary class, right? So this is a sermon. This is a church. This is Sunday morning. It's a worship service. So like the approach that we would take in a class would be very boom, 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 boom. What we're going to be doing here is we're going to take some deep dives into some of this theological stuff, but we're going to make it very practical. Somewhere in the message, we're going to have something that we can latch on for our lives and that we need to think about as believers living today, 2014, at the very end, the last gasp of Earth's history before the return of the Lord, I believe. Well, Peter calls him a dangerous adversary. He says he's like a roaring lion, pouncing, waiting to pounce, circling, waiting to pounce. And he goes about seeking victims to devour. This imagery, by the way, this idea of a lion circling, ready to pounce, would have been very significant to the believers who this was being written to, because this was a time of the Colosseum and the lions, right? They would have made a connection with this imagery of how dangerous the devil is. You know, you're in an arena, and there's a literal lion, and he's hungry, and he's circling, and he's waiting to pounce. That's what the devil's like when you're not in the arena. Or you're not in a physical arena. It's quite a thing to say to believers, even today. Finally, he's declared to be opposed to God, to the people of God, and to the work of God on the earth in every way. He persecutes the saints. Pastor Bacon gets up here every Sunday morning, and we pray for another country. And when we do, these are countries where believers are being persecuted because of the great enemy of God's person, God's people, and God's work. He persecutes saints and accuses them continually before God in Revelation chapter 12 and verse 10, the B part. He has many emissaries, the Bible tells us. He dethrones reason. He engenders confusion. There's no confusion in God. There should be no confusion in the people of God. Our marching orders are straightforward. But he engenders confusion. He tortures human beings. He moves them into superstition, idolatry, or flat-out atheism, doing all that he can to get those who have been created in the very image of God to deny their good creator. Do you think that Satan has been effective in these days? And meanwhile, the world is dying in the darkness, and the church can't fight it because they're asleep in the light. Dr. William Cook describes Satan and his work in this way. I'm quoting here, the archfiend called Satan, which means the adversary, is called the old serpent because of his guile. He's a liar from the beginning and the father of lies. He delights in destroying the souls of men, and he goes about like a roaring lion seeking who he may devour. Not only is he a destroyer, but he's a murderer of both bodies and souls, and the arts of his seduction always have to do with murder as its ultimate object. All sin and all of the sin and misery of our world for the past 6,000 years and the sin and the misery of the future history that the world will encounter, all the miseries of hell is not only the result of his influence, but in these results, he and his minions find their greatest gratification. Well, We're about to examine this person in some detail. It's important that we do this because if we're going to resist the enemy, we have to know the enemy. We ended with that illustration about Patton and last week and coming against Rommel and knowing Rommel's strategies because he read his book. We need to read the book. We need to be ready. We need to be able to anticipate what is happening. And Paul tells us to be diligent in this way. First, one of the most famous passages. I mean, it's quoted ad infinitum, ad nauseum. Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 10. Be strong in the Lord and the strength of his might. Put on the whole armor of God. Why? Why do I need to put on the whole armor of God, Paul? So that you may be able to stand against the schemes of the devil. For supernatural warfare. And then Paul goes on to say, so get this, write it down, understand this. We're not wrestling as much as we think our enemy is that person who's trying to attack us, that person at work that's trying to attack us, that person at school, that person in the neighborhood who's trying to slander us and take away our good testimony. As much as we think the enemy is that person, we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but what does he say? Against rulers and authorities and cosmic powers over this present darkness. What a way to describe our age. Present darkness against spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places or the heavenly realms. So we need to understand the enemy. We're going to begin to do that. Now, I want to tell you, I'm going to put up things like this while I'm speaking. They're going to come up. They are not an outline. They are just, as I'm moving along, these are just thoughts that are kind of restating something that I've enucleated in my talk about what the scriptures say about Satan. So you can jot those down. They just kind of, you know, consolidate those ideas. And we'll do that throughout this series. We'll just put up points like that. They're not in order chronologically or point by point. They're not meant to be an outline. They're just meant to kind of consolidate and, you know, put a pin, attack in something so that we can think about it later. And we'll be giving you the biblical evidences for these things as we move along, okay? So the first thing that I want to do is, this seems, you know, like really kind of, really? Did you have to say that? I know that the folks who are in this room are going to have no problem with this. But we do need to talk about this. Satan is a person who really exists because there are lots of false views about Satan. It's shocking to people when you talk to a Satanist or you listen to interviews by modern-day Satanists. The thing that is often surprising to people who are listening is that Satanists don't believe in Satan. Satanists today do not believe that there's a literal person called Satan. They believe Satan is a principle. It's an alternative to Christianity. Satan is a, he's not a, a person. And so this is an attack that often comes. The most prominent view today is that he's a principle of evil that we find working in the earth. So you can call it Satan, you can call it whatever you want to call it. But let's dispense with this nonsense right off the bat. When we talk about Satan, we are talking about a person who actually exists. Not only that, we'll see, a person that actually exists and was created by God. Now, there's a lot of avenues that we could go down to prove this, and we're going to do it very quickly because I don't think I have to spend a lot of time on this, that he truly exists as a person and not just a malevolent force. First of all, he's mentioned in 7 of the 39 books of the Old Testament and 19 of the 27 books of the New Testament, and Jesus himself taught about Satan as a person who truly exists. In all 4 Gospels, which are historical books, the 4 authorized biographies of our Lord Jesus Christ, in all 4 of the Gospels, we find mention of Satan and Jesus talking about Satan. He's mentioned 29 times in the Gospels. And of these, in 25 of them, Jesus is actually talking about Satan. So to deny his existence, watch this now, to deny the existence of Satan as a person is to contradict the testimony of Jesus Christ himself. I'll just point out a couple of things. Matthew chapter 4, Jesus is in the wilderness. And the Bible says that he was tempted by the devil for 40 days and 40 nights. Now, verse 3 says, the tempter came and said to him, if you are, he's affirming that he is. We could translate that, since you are the Son of God. And what does he say? He says, since you are the Son of God, command these stones to become loaves of bread. The devil always seeks to tempt us away from the perfect will that God has for our lives. So he says, listen, you're the Son of God, turn these stones into loaves of bread. And so Jesus replies in famously three times from Deuteronomy. Jesus quotes from Deuteronomy. Jesus answers, it's written that man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God, quoting again from the book of Deuteronomy. Then the devil took him to a holy city and put him on the pinnacle of the temple. And he said, throw yourself down, because it's written, he will command his angels concerning you. He knows this is a messianic passage. It's a prophetic passage. It's written, he will command his angels concerning you. On their hands he will bear you up, lest you strike your foot. Do you know that the devil knows the Bible? You think you know the Bible? I think I know the Bible? Compared to Satan, not even a little bit. Not even a little bit. And not only does he know the Bible, he quotes the Bible. He twists the scriptures to his own ends. Well, you know, listen, Jesus, throw yourself down. Tempt God. God says you would do this. And believers are never to tempt God. You know, we jump off a building, we may find that beneath us are not necessarily the everlasting arms, but the very hard earth. That's not the way that we prove our faith in God. And this is what he's suggesting that he does. Again, the devil took him to a high mountain, showed him all the kingdoms of the world. Everybody wants to be famous. Do you know what I've noticed lately? Have you ever noticed how many celebrities are failing, falling apart? Their lives are an absolute train wreck. Marriages have almost a 0% chance. You hear about somebody in Hollywood that's been married for more than 10 minutes, and it's shocking, right? Do you know why? I'm just wondering. Maybe, I'm not sure, but maybe people were never meant to be worshipped. Maybe we don't have a capacity to be worshipped. Maybe we don't have a capacity for people to tell us how great we are all the time. You know why? Because we're not. We're sinners saved by a holy God, and anything that we do that's good is because of God's mercy and goodness working through us. And everything that we do is bad is because we're just being ourselves. Anyway, surely Jesus is susceptible to this. The devil is so inflated with his own pride, as we're going to see. Surely Jesus is, he wants to be famous too. So the devil takes him to a high mountain, shows him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to him, all this I will give to you. I only need one thing. If you'll bow down and worship me. This reveals what's at the heart of the devil's greatest desire, to be worshipped. And he is. He's worshipped by those who don't even believe that he's a person. To worship anything else but the true and living God is to worship the devil. And then obviously he failed against the Lord Jesus Christ. I might even say it wasn't even a fair fight. But, by the way, Jesus knew this enemy. We're going to see this. This is not like the first time I met Satan. Long before there was Adam and Eve and the garden of God as we currently understand it from Genesis 2 and 3, the devil was very, very familiar with the second person of the Trinity. Well, knowing that he had failed, verse 13 says that the devil left him, and behold, angels came to minister to him. That's Jesus. And when the devil had ended his temptation, he departed from him for a more opportune time. And all throughout the ministry and life of Jesus, the devil was looking for an opportune time. We'll see some of these as we go forward. Now, what am I trying to prove here? I'm trying to prove that Jesus was not crazy and was not having a full-blown, full-on conversation with a principal. He was having a full-on, full-blown conversation with a person. Satan is a person. Satan would love for us to think otherwise, but he's a real being whose existence is clearly taught in the Old and New Testaments, and especially by the Lord Jesus Christ himself. Satan is not only mentioned in apocalyptic literature, like, you know, the book of Revelation and Daniel in the Old Testament, but he is written about in the prophetic and historical books of the Bible. I could go on and on with this, but this is just enough to say that Satan is a real person. Now, let's begin to talk about Satan's origin. Who is he? Where does he come from? Is he eternal? All of these things. We have the answer to this question in this amazing passage that Jim read for us today. And it answers some of these. But before we can get into it, it needs a little bit of explaining. Because it's dealing with, it's a prophecy against the king of Tyre. Tyre was an ancient, very rich society, and it was eventually overthrown by Alexander the Great in this, like, really famous way. You know, it was like an island fortress, and so when nobody could conquer it because it was this, island thing, and they were on the land, and so Alexander said, just take Earth, throw it in the... And they literally made a land bridge to Tyre from the mainland, and they destroyed Tyre. And by the way, this was a fulfillment of a prophecy, too. The prophecies against Tyre, although it was one of the most glorious cities of the ancient world, one of the prophets said that it will be the place for the spreading of nets. And to this day, the place where Tyre existed is a place where fishermen lay out their nets in the sun to dry. Anyway, Tyre was wicked. Very rich, wicked. And so in Ezekiel 28, Ezekiel is getting this prophecy, and it's against the ruler of Tyre at the beginning. But then somewhere along the line, the ruler of Tyre is, you're a bad guy, you're a blasphemer. He presented himself like God, as many of the Roman emperors did the same. But he was presenting himself as God. All of this is clearly blasphemous. And then he's, talking about how God's judgment is going to come upon him. But then when we get to verse 11, things change. He stops talking about the ruler of Tyre and talks about the king of Tyre, which we would think are the same things. But it becomes very evident very quickly that they are not. Because as he begins talking about this king of Tyre, he describes him in ways that could not possibly be talking about a human being, about an ordinary person, about any king. He uses language that is obviously talking about, and it's almost universally accepted, that this is talking about a description of Satan's fall and the way he was created. And the idea being in the larger picture of Ezekiel 28 is that the blasphemy and the megalomania of the ruler of Tyre is being informed and sponsored by the true king of Tyre, who is the devil himself. Well, let's take a look at it. Let's look at the passage once again. We're going to see in this passage, just as a heads up before we get through it, you're going to see that in this passage, this king of Tyre was in Eden, the garden of God. But the Eden, the garden of God that is described, is not the one that green flowery place that we find Adam and Eve in. It's a primordial garden of Eden. We believe that everything was changed because of the fall of Satan, especially on the earth. And that happens between the first two verses of the Bible. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And then Satan's fall comes. And the Hebrew of verse 2 can be read like this: and the earth had become without form and void. And we believe that was because of a catastrophic judgment of Satan's fall. And then what we find in the rest of the chapter, you never see any creation until you get to animals and people. What you find is the earth being renovated. God said, let the trees and the grass and everything appear, and the waters are being separated, not create all this. So anyway, he's in Eden, the garden of God. So keep an eye out for that. The king of Tyre wasn't in Eden. I'm pretty sure about that. Or the human king of Tyre. Also, he's called an angelic being, a cherub. who covers. That's interesting. Furthermore, look at this. He was sinless, Ezekiel tells us. From the day he was created. Now, can you imagine Ezekiel saying that about any human being? There hasn't been a sinless person since Adam, and he fell, right? And he fell. We've all been born sinners, but he was sinless until iniquity was found in him. So as we put this together, Charles Dyer has it right, Dr. Charles Dyer, when he says the best explanation of this king and ruler of Tyre is that now we're shifting gears into the spiritual force that's behind the wickedness of the blasphemous ruler of Tyre. Okay, let's look at it. Verse 11, this is where the change takes place. Moreover, the word of Yahweh came to me, saying, Son of man, raise up a lamentation. This is a funeral dirge. Raise up a lamentation over the king of Tyre and say to him, Thus says the Lord God, you were the signet of perfection. Other translations have you were the model of perfection, or you were the seal of perfection. This is a Hebrew idiom that means you were the pinnacle. You were all that and a bag of chips. You were everything. And watch this. Now we're talking about Satan before his fall. You were the signet of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You know those days you go to the mirror, you fall in love? You see, I don't want to shave this. It's like an oil paint, and it's perfect just the way it is, right? No, well, you know what? He really had something to talk about. And the Bible says that his beauty, we're going to see, puffed him up with pride, brought about pride, and that pride corrupted his wisdom. But you know what? Wisdom that's corrupted is still very clever. Do you know what James tells us? There's a wisdom that is from, and there's a wisdom that is, but they're both wisdom. And the world today is following the wisdom of the world. I like the wisdom of God better. I like the wisdom from above better. You know why? Because it's peaceable, and I really need peace. So, watch this now. You were in Eden. I'm just going to read it, and then I'll comment, because I'll just, you know what I'll do. You were in Eden, the garden of God, and every precious stone was your covering. These stones are very significant, folks. They may put a light on in you. Every precious stone was your covering, the sardis, the topaz, the diamond, beryl, onyx, jasper, sapphire, emerald, carbuncle. And crafted in gold were your settings and your engravings. That's a terrible translation. If you have a King James Bible, you have something very different, and yours is right. We'll talk about that as we move along. On the day that you were created, watch this, all of these things, this is a uniform of glory. I'll explain in a moment. And on the day that you were created, they were prepared. God said, when I made you for this suit of glory, whatever that is, and we're going to try to discern it together. You were an appointed guardian cherub. Now, if you have an NASB 95, it says you were the appointed guardian or covering cherub. Covering is better. The instead of a is better. But I placed you. In other words, I'm the one that put you in that position. You were on the holy mountain of God. Mountains are the place in the, when we talk about the presence of God. Mountains are the place where the presence of God is. You'll remember when Moses led Aaron and the 70 elders up to the mountain where they saw the presence of God, right? You remember Mount Sinai and the fire. You remember Mount Zion. The Bible talks about Mount Zion as being the... So this is a picture of God's authority, God's presence. I placed you there on the holy mountain of God, and in the midst of the stones of fire you walked. We'll have to save that for another day. You were blameless, Satan. You were blameless in all your ways from the day you were created until iniquity was found in you. And then he begins to talk about Satan's fall and subsequent judgment, some of which is still future. I'll just read it. In the abundance of your trade. By the way, this idea of trade is from going from person to person. It's merchandising. And we're going to see that this is what Satan did to lure away one-third of the angels in heaven away from God. In the abundance of your merchandise, the slanderer, right? You were filled with violence in your midst, and you sinned, and I cast you as profane from the holy mountain. That is from my presence. Now, some of this is future, so we're going to talk about this, but just roll with it for now. I destroyed you, O covering cherub or guardian cherub, from the midst of the stones of fire. Your heart was proud because of your beauty. See it? You corrupted your wisdom for the sake of your splendor. Your beauty caused your wisdom to be corrupted. I cast you to the ground. That doesn't happen until Revelation chapter 12. I cast you to the ground. I exposed you before kings to feast their eyes upon you. By the multitude of your iniquities in the unrighteousness of your trade, there's that slanderous going back and forth about God. In the unrighteousness of your trade, you profaned your sanctuaries. So I brought fire out from your midst, and I consumed you and turned you to ash on the earth and in the sight of all who saw you. And who know you among the peoples are all who know you among the peoples are appalled at you, and you have come to a dreadful end and shall be no more forever. Okay, now there are at least four things that we should pull from this passage with respect to our study today. This is not the last time we're going to see Ezekiel 28, 11 and following. It's a very, very important passage about Satan, obviously. But four things we should pull today. Number one, Satan was the signet of perfection, or the phrase means you sealed up the sum, and some translations have it that way. You sealed up the sum, Satan. You were the whole package. You were perfect. And you sealed up the sum specifically in two areas. First, you were full of wisdom, and second, you were perfect in beauty. The poet and artist William Blake painted this picture in watercolors. Unfortunately, it's in a very poor state. It's been a little bit enhanced here, but it's owned by the Tate Gallery. It's called Satan in His Original Glory. Thou wast perfect till iniquity was found in you. It was painted in 1805. His work almost seems like modern work today. There was nobody that was working like this at the time. And he wanted to try to show what Satan was like before his fall in his painting. He wanted to show him as the prince of the world. And you can see he's got the orb here in his left hand, and he's got the scepter in his right hand. And you might say, well, listen, an orb, you know, holding the world. You've seen the Salvador Mundi paintings of Jesus where he's got that orb in his hand, right? He's got the whole orb in his, you know the songs. Come on. If you're not listening to the Rolling Stones all the time, you'd know that other song. And drop kick me Jesus through the goalpost. Anyway, so he's got the orb in one hand, and in his right hand he's got the scepter. And you say, well, that's a lot to say about Satan. Like, is he in control like that? Well, John chapter 14 in verse 30, Jesus called Satan the ruler of this world. Jesus said to his disciples on the night that he was betrayed, I will no longer talk much more with you, for the ruler of this world, the word world there is cosmos, is coming, but he has nothing in me. And then again in John chapter 12 and verse 31, we'll study these verses in detail when we get to them in 2029. But he says, now is the judgment of the world. Jesus said this, the ruler of this world is cast out. So Jesus called Satan the ruler of the world twice in the Gospel of John. 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 4, Paul calls Satan the god of this world, or literally the god of this age, hotheos to ionos. Ionos means an age, and we don't have the word world there. But notice it. He called him the god of this age, or in another place he would say this present darkness. Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 2 calls him a prince. Paul says he's the prince of the power of the air, who is the spirit who is now working in the sons of disobedience. The apostle John says, listen, does it get any clearer than this? 1 John chapter 4 and verse 4 says he calls him he who is in the world, reminding believers that he who is in us is greater than he who is in the world. And then I had another one, but I can't seem to find it. It's also from 1 John. Oh, here it is. I'm sorry. I skipped it. 1 John chapter 5 and verse 19 says that the whole world is in the power of the evil one. Do you think the devil is someone that we should take for granted, even in this age? Dr. Fruchtenbaum writes that of all created beings, Satan is by far the wisest and most beautiful of them all. All of the portraits of Satan by artists that have been painted throughout the centuries seem to portray him as ugly, gaunt, hideous, and they're simply wrong. The exact opposite is true. Of all the created beings, Satan is the wisest and the most beautiful. So that's the first thing. The second thing we should draw from this passage is that he is indeed a created being. He's not eternal. God has no beginning and God has no end. Satan had a beginning. God created him. Satan is not a principle of evil, as we've seen, but he's an actual person that God created. And at the time of his creation, this passage declares that there are at least two things that were true about him. First of all, he had a covering of stones. These are translucent stones. Angels have bodies, but bodies made of light. He had translucent stones covering a uniform of these stones. Now you can imagine when the glory that would come from his very person, this light being, would shine through those stones. You can imagine the dazzling appearance he would have. So dazzling that he was able to woo one-third of his angels away from worshiping God to worshiping him. God gave him this covering, this suit of stones. It's an amazing thing. Every precious stone was your covering. The sardis, the topaz, diamond, beryl, onyx, jasper, sapphire, emerald, carbuncle, crafted in gold were your settings and engravings. On the day that you were created, they were prepared. So this uniform of precious stones is reminiscent of something, and you might have caught it. What do they remind us of? The stones that are on the high priest's vestments. This is about worship. Not only that, the 12 stones, next slide, please, Deacon Steve. The 12 stones that make up the foundation of the New Jerusalem are these same stones. So this is a place of an exalted position that has everything to do with holy things and worship. And God says, you know what? The day that you were created, I prepared them for you. So very interesting. Just put a tack in it. And we're going to go there. Secondly, he was apparently in charge of leading worship in heaven. And you know, one of the dangers of being a worship leader or a singer or a musician is this idea of people saying that you are, you know, I mean, lots of singers are idolized. Mick Jagger is idolized, right? These are some of the most famous people in the world. They're idolized. And so apparently this was a problem, the fact that he was leading worship. Now, here's a little problem that we're going to have, and I've got to really move along here quickly. But a little problem that we're going to have is you don't have anything about these pipes and timbres, right, in your Bibles because of a really unfortunate translation. These are instruments of worship. Pipes and tabrets are mentioned in the C part of Ezekiel 28, verse 13. Now, in our translation, it just says something about your settings and your sockets were prepared for you. But in the King James Bible, you read something very differently. The word that's used here, that's translated here in the Old Testament, is the same word, the first word, the tambres, right, is the same word that is used when it says that Miriam picked up her tambourine to worship the Lord, and all the other women picked up their tambourines to worship the Lord. Same word. This is a tambourine. It's a hand drum, right? It's got a skin over it. It's a hand drum. But modern translators tend to look at this because of the second word, which can be a word that, you know, settings and sockets. It can be a jeweler's term for something you put a jewel in. And they say, well, with what came before, all these jewels, he must be talking about that. But there's definitely no controversy about the first word. This is talking about a tambourine. And so the King James Version, if you have a King James Version, you're going to be shocked when you read it. And it says that, it says it somewhere here. I think I have it in my notes. I can't believe I didn't put the verse here. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, is it? Okay. You put it up here when I wasn't looking. The workmanship, here's what it says. Here's what it says in the King James and New King James. The workmanship of your tabrets and pipes was prepared for you on the day you were created. Now, that's a literal translation of the Hebrew. It's not a different Hebrew in modern translations, but this second word here, pipes, it means something that can be bored through. So it could, you know, speak of like a wind instrument, something like that. But because it could also be a jeweler's term, a lot of the modern translators associate it with the jewels that came before it, and they just say your settings and your sockets were prepared for you. No, I think that the King James has it right here. This word timbrels especially means a tambourine, okay? And what this is indicating is, remember I said the significance of all of these stones is that they are used in respect to worship. Holy things, the foundation stones of the New Jerusalem, the stones that are on the high priest's garments, right? The second part of it is leading worship in heaven through music, because this is the word that that is used of Miriam worshiping the Lord with these tablets. So the idea of the phrase, I think, is that on the day that you were created, I prepared you to use the timbrels and the pipes. So we could go on and on about what these are, but I think that what it is like a 1-2 punch against, hey, you were involved with holy, worshipful things. Dr. Ronald Fruchtenbaum says, I'm quoting here, Satan was in charge of the tabrets and the pipes. These are things involved with worship. When Satan was created, he served as the one who led worship of God as he sat upon the throne. Satan is pictured as being a priest in heaven, leading the worship of God. J. Vernon McGee, who was brilliant, but more of a preacher than a theologian, but he writes this: Satan was a band; he was music itself. And then he makes a very interesting point. Do you know what the origin of music is on the earth? Go back to Genesis chapter 4 and verse 21, and you will find that it originated in the progeny of Cain. Cain, who killed his brother. Remember, Satan was a musician. McGee says. So before his fall, this astonishing covering angel was very significant. He was involved in worship in heaven. Third thing we should draw from this is a passage about Satan's origin. He's a cherub. And we'll say more about this later because I am a little strapped for time here, but he is a covering cherub. Cherub are the highest order of angelic beings. Cherubim, seraphim, and then rank and file angels. We'll have more to say about that later, but he's specifically called a cherub in this passage in Ezekiel. I'm going to move to the fourth thing at the bottom of the page, Steve, because I'm looking at the time here and I'm having a panic attack. The fourth thing we should mention in the passage is that it declares that Satan was perfect at the time of his creation. Not a single flaw was in him. He sealed up the sum. He was not only perfect, but he had a unique ability, one that God does not have. Satan had the ability to make choices that were contrary to his own nature. God cannot do that. That's why God cannot sin. That's why God cannot lie. But Satan did. And we're going to talk about Satan's sin and Satan's fall. And it's really astonishing, and we kind of get that in Isaiah chapter 14 and verse 12, where Isaiah says, how you have fallen from heaven, O day star, O son of the dawn. So we'll contemplate that together. Now, in our concluding 90 minutes together, I want to just make an application before we leave. This is a lot of theological stuff about Satan. And so what we have to do is kind of answer the so what question. Why does it matter? Okay, I know a little bit more about his origins this morning, but why does it matter? Well, one of the most remarkable things to consider in the New Testament is that God, Jesus specifically, right, allowed Satan to be sifted just as he allowed Job to be sifted by the devil in the Old Testament. And here's the truth, friends. He may allow you or I to be sifted as well, any time that it suits his purposes. Now, on the night that Jesus was betrayed at the Last Supper, Jesus looked at Peter. Peter loved Jesus. We know that, right? Loved him with all of his heart. And Jesus looked at Peter and look at what he said. Simon, Simon, look, behold, this is the Greek asterismos. Look, Satan has demanded to have you that he might sift you like wheat. Now, what's not explicit in the passage but is very true is that Jesus said yes. And we know this by the next thing that Jesus says to him. Go ahead. But I have prayed for you that your faith may not fail. And when you have turned again, strengthen your brothers. In other words, Peter, you're in for a rough couple of months. But I've prayed for you. So essentially what he's saying is the devil has demanded to have you that he might sift you like wheat. And Satan, I've said yes, but I've prayed for you. And when you recover, encourage your brothers. Okay? Now, Jesus, we look at that and we say, wow, that doesn't sound right. But then we look at the book of Job and we see that when Satan goes before God, where have you been? Oh, going to and fro throughout the world, looking, checking things out. And God is the one who says, have you considered Job? God is the one who allows him to do what he does with Job. So Peter's sifting that Jesus allowed would occur that very night. That night is the night where he would come upon those people who would say, you look like that one that was with Jesus. And he'd say, oh, I don't even know him. Three times before the cock crowed, denying that he even knew the Lord. Peter's sifting would be that night. And Peter would be in despair about it. Peter would stand afar off from the cross. He wouldn't be at the foot of the cross like John. I think a part of that was because he was ashamed. That awkward meeting when he was on the boat and he sees Jesus and he swims and he rushes to the shore. But after the exuberance is done and all of a sudden the reality of the betrayal kicks in, I think there was shame. And Jesus looks at him and he says, Peter, do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? Three times. And gives Peter the opportunity to reaffirm his love for each time that he denied him. It's an awkward thing, right? He was sifted. Now, Peter couldn't believe that this could be true of him. Jesus said, Peter, you're going to be sifted. Peter says, I am ready to go to prison for you, to die for you. And Jesus says, it's not even going to be morning yet, before the cock crows. You're going to deny three times that you even know me, Peter. You're going to be sifted. I'm ready to go to prison for you. I'm ready to die for you. But this doesn't tell the whole story. So we hear this and we read it. Simon, Simon, Satan has desired to have you that he might sift you like wheat. Okay. Does Satan still ask for people to sift? In both testaments, that's the testimony, right? But this isn't giving us the whole story. Because when he says, Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has demanded to have you, the you is plural, that he might sift you, the you is plural. So he's talking to Peter, and he says, Peter, Simon, Simon, Satan has demanded to have all of you, that he might sift all of you like wheat. But I prayed for you, Peter. And when you recover, strengthen your brothers. What is this telling us? This is telling us that Jesus is speaking to Peter about Satan. And he's telling him, Peter, you're in danger. You are in danger. Oh, no, come on, Jesus. I would die for you. Not now you wouldn't, Peter. You're about to be sifted. That couldn't possibly be true of me. Maybe we think like this today. I could never deny the Lord in word or deed. But here's what Jesus says. Not only are you in danger, Peter, all of you are in danger. every one of you. Peter, tonight's your night. You're going to be sifted tonight. It's going to be a really, really rough couple of weeks going forward. But I've prayed for you. You're going to make it because God's people always make it. That's the doctrine of perseverance. We make it at the end. We're at the finish line, not because of our victory, but because of the Lord's victory in us. Back in these days, they would take a winnowing sieve and they would take the wheat that had been harvested and they would put it in this sieve and it would separate the wheat from the chaff, the good stuff from the bad stuff. And God, when Satan asks, can I have Jeff? Just give me a week. Just a week. And God may say, throw him in. He said to Job, he encouraged Satan to throw Job in. Make no mistake about it. In the sifting, in sifting Peter and all of the other disciples as wheat, Satan's desire was to destroy them, as his desire is to destroy us. The thief, Jesus says, comes to steal and to kill and destroy. I came that they might have life and have it more abundantly. This would be a painful sifting for Peter, but Jesus prayed for him. And when he was done, he would strengthen his brothers. Are you ready for this? Who is it that told us in a humbler moment? Peter goes in very self-assured. I will never do that. I will die for you. I will go to prison for you. Very self-assured, very confident. After this sifting, Peter is humbler. And who's the one who tells us, be alert? Because the devil is like a roaring lion circling you, looking for someone to devour. Who tells us that? Peter does, right? So, while we're being sifted, we have the promise of the Lord's Prayer. The Lord, by that I mean the Lord praying for us. Hebrews chapter 7, verse 25 says that Jesus ever liveth to make intercession for us. So we're never alone in our sifting. But when the time comes, when we have to take the witness stand and God says, go ahead and test him. Jesus said to Peter, I've prayed for you, and he prays for us as well. Why does Jesus say yes when Satan asks to sift his people? Well, I think we have the answer here. When you have turned again, strengthen your brothers. Sometimes he allows us to be sifted for other people so that we can be a testimony of the goodness of God in the days to come. Well, after his fall, Peter was humbler and he gave us this warning about the devil. And I want to just go back to this in the last 2 minutes of our message here. He said, told us about the devil, that he's circling around us, seeking someone to devour, said this to the early believers. Do you know what I think Peter was saying? I think he was saying to us, to the audience that he was writing to, and to all believers, because this is a part of the general epistles of the New Testament. He was saying to all of us what Jesus said to him that night. Peter, Satan has asked for you, all of you, and I've said yes. You know what I think Peter was saying? Church, you're in danger. You are always in danger. You are always in danger of being seduced by the evil one. The one that was so seductive that he was able to seduce one-third of the angels in heaven who had access to the glory of God from turning away from him. What chance do we possibly have against this clever, evil person that God created and fell? The only answer that we have is this full armor of God that Paul tells us to put on so that we may fight against the strategies of the devil. Well, so here's the thing I want to leave you with this morning. I wonder, just wondering, I don't know, but I wonder if Satan has whispered your name into God's ear recently. I wonder if he's whispered my name into God's ear recently. I wonder what Jesus would say He's the adversary. The Bible tells, not Jesus, Satan is the adversary. The Bible tells us that he accuses the brethren day and night before God. That's how we know he still has access. We'll talk about this a little bit next time. But Peter finally came to understand that the believer is in continuous peril because of the real, actively prowling enemy that we have, which we call Satan. So the question is, are you ready for your sifting? Are you like Peter saying, I don't know. I'm okay. Yeah. I can do it. I can handle it. I would die for Jesus. What I find about the evangelical church today is many won't even be inconvenienced for Jesus. Never mind dying. So, what will you say in the days ahead? I wonder, are we overconfident? Are we even dismissive of the danger? Have we been so put upon by the scientific age and the milieu, this zeitgeist that we're living in that says we've figured everything out and don't need God to answer these deep questions anymore, that we are just dismissive of the danger? And in my day of sifting, will I fare better than Peter? Will I fare as well as Job? I pray that we all will. I pray that the Lord will strengthen us as we get to know our enemy better, that we'll be able to stand for the Lord in the evil day, because we're going to need his strength in the days ahead, because the time is coming when the demonic activity that will be let loose on this earth will be unparalleled.